Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Feed the Wolf, Befriending Our Fears in the Way of St. Francis, by John M. Sweeney. Narrated by Mike Carnes. Preface. He knew poets and musicians, soldiers and generals, mothers and fathers, merchants and travelers, sea captains and sultans. He knew rulers and fools, popes and court entertainers, cardinals and criminals and lovers. Francis of Assisi's life was the stuff of legend. People were even calling him a saint while he was still living, not because of any supernatural performances or special revelations from the divine, but because, to use the language of a beautiful song by Sarah McLachlan, Francis lived a life filled with more ordinary miracles. Each chapter of this book illustrates those ordinary miracles, providing a context for his life. Each chapter offers brief episodes of conversation that create a kind of oral history by imagining people who usually have no voice in the record of his life, but who we know were there talking about him. These voices appear in the middle of each chapter like a chorus. The nature of ordinary miracles is that they can be repeated. Francis's 800-year-old path began as the way of Jesus, made tangible in the 13th century, and I wouldn't be writing about it if I didn't believe it remains the surest way for a person today to turn away from fear and find grace in modern life. January 23, 2021. Feast of St. Mary Ann Cope of Molokai. Introduction. I take comfort in the witness of the ancient white pine. Many years of walking in the woods of Vermont and Wisconsin, gathering firewood, have taught me how a white pine can stand 90 feet tall or more, and every other branch, at any given time, may be dead. If I fix my grip on the right low-hanging limb, its dry wood cracks easily with a strong pole. You don't see this in a maple, which lives wholly, every branch blooming with leaves each new spring until it doesn't anymore. When one offshoot of the maple tree dies, the whole tree soon will perish. But not the towering white pine. It has the ability to accommodate death and keep returning year after year for a century or more. Like every other human being who has been on this planet for a half century or more, I have experienced suffering and failure and death. I used to think I was lucky, that the big events had passed me by. I was, and they did. But as you grow older, there is a slow, dripping accumulation, like the gradual wearing away of cavern rock that begins to feel like water rising around your ankles. Mentors die. A marriage ends. You witness friends in terrible pain. Relationships sour. There's the loss of career or jobs. Moves feel like losses too, and then, in your 50s, friends begin to die with a disturbingly annual regularity. But like that tree, I try to keep growing and sprouting leaves each spring. It's this desire to keep growing I see in St. Francis, and I believe he shows us how to lean into life. He too experienced failure, a forever split with a parent, a friend's betrayal, physical suffering, moments of humiliation, and death. But he was able to live his life with a flourish. Spirit seems to have filled him with hope and love in ways that made me look and say, "I'd like some of that, please." So brief investigations into his way of life to learn for myself, to share with you, are the approach I take in this book. You might even consider each of the chapters a kind of experiment in Francis living. People call him a poet and artist. He was. People call him simple and naive, and he probably was those things too. Children used to throw dirt and mock him, finding him ridiculous compared to their parents and other adults living within the margins. What is most interesting to me is that if he were alive today, doing what he did then, we would likely also dismiss him. We may not throw rocks. Medieval children were transparent in ways that we rarely allow ourselves to be. But we'd find him irrelevant, a fool. Or his way of living would go unnoticed. If we even noticed him, we would hold him in dismissive disdain. His actions were inexplicable, like the guy in the alley who bangs on my trash cans. Francis's teachings seem overly simple, without much to engage my desire to debate. Yet people did notice him. People were drawn to his way of living from the start, and his movement grew like no spiritual movement had before him. But he wasn't easy. From the distance of history, it's easy to love him today. Close up, however, he was sometimes difficult to be around. Imagine an athlete in a team sport who demands of fans in the bleachers what he demands of himself. Francis did that. Then, when he was gone from the scene, on a mission or long journey, many came to join what he'd started, inspired by the stories of Francis, but they didn't know him personally. They had difficulty imagining how their famous founder could combine joy and pleasure with such severity of commitment. One or the other had to be sacrificed, they imagined. This is when some began to frame Francis in ways that failed to appreciate his art. While he was still living in this miserable and mournful world, our blessed Father Francis begins a chapter in one of the primary source materials on Francis. But Francis would never have spoken of the world as miserable or mournful. And for his followers to do so was like surrounding a lush landscape painting with a sad, dull metal frame. This was, in fact, the frame that often surrounded his story and teachings centuries after his death. It's only since the early 1900s that the perception of him has changed, making him the world's most popular saint. At the turn of the previous century, a renaissance of interest in Francis began, spurred on by a few people who began to tell the story of who he really was. They had to go beyond the hagiography and find the real person. The first to reveal the real Francis was Paul Sabatier, a French Protestant pastor who published the first modern biography in 1894. It was quickly translated into a dozen other languages. Then came a Danish writer, Johannes Jorgensen, later nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature, with another important biography. They both presented Francis as a person of contemporary relevance. Meanwhile, a medieval folktale inspired by Francis and his holy foolery, called The Juggler of Notre Dame, saw the light as a magazine story, an opera, a choreographed dance, and a tale in popular children's books. A generation later came the best film ever made about a saint, Roberto Rossellini's The Flowers of St. Francis in 1950, co-written by a young Federico Fellini. All the actors, except one, were non-actors. Most of them were Franciscan friars drawn to the project for personal and religious reasons. The one who played the part of Francis was not even mentioned in the credits. It was as if an actor couldn't portray Francis on the screen. He was too real for that. That film became one of the great classics of Italian neorealism. Then Nikos Kazantzakis, the charismatic and controversial Greek writer who also wrote The Last Temptation of Christ, penned the powerful and picturesque God's Pauper, published as St. Francis in the United States, bringing the saint to life as the human he was in ways that only a novel can. In one scene describing the stigmata, for example, when Francis is purported to have received wounds matching those of Christ in his passion, an event about which most biographers remain mostly silent for lack of evidence, Kazantzakis depicts the scene in a field of fire, with lightning flashing and Francesco yelling, "I want more!" But before this Renaissance got underway, there were those who saw Francis as an example of how the Church often turns a good Christian into an irrelevant saint. Before the rediscovery of the true Francis began, a little more than a century ago, he was stuck in this saccharine sweetness of cuddly animal stories. He was so saintly as to be safe for everyone but sinners and the suffering. There was no way the real Francis could be found. With his reputation locked up safely in unrelatable legends, there was little chance for his relevance and inspiring action today. The Protestant reformer Martin Luther was among Francis's prominent critics. By the time Luther was a young monk, around 1500, Franciscans, those followers of Francis, so identified with their founder that he eclipsed reverence for Christ. Early followers of Francis were so eager to provide reasons for that level of honor that they even claimed to find Francis foretold in the Old Testament and by Christ himself. A lot of what Luther protested was this kind of ridiculous leader worship, which is why Luther found such a ready audience for his critiques. No one, he said, should turn saints into idols. This is not my approach. My hope is to see a continued renaissance of interest in Francis, the real Francis. This Francis was earthy and rough, like burlap, not bronzed and sculpted like the Baroque fountain cherubim some have made him out to be. I've written other books about him, and I imagine some readers may wonder, why another? I continue to ask myself the same question, and the answer comes back. We need accessible entrees to spiritual practice for who we are and how we live in the present moment, and Francis still offers the best set of practices I have found anywhere. So I'm setting out to make those practices simple and clear for you and me. I hope you can use this book the way someone might follow a map to a hidden treasure. Once you've made it there, you have no more need of the map. Toss it away, but keep the treasure you find. One afternoon recently, I was talking with a group of high school students. Their teacher asked if I would introduce them to Francis of Assisi. I started out with a bit of biography and something about the times in which he lived, imagining that the medieval history would be fascinating to some. But by this time I saw the lack of fascination on their bored faces, so I pivoted. Okay, enough history and background. Let's try this instead. Look for a moment at your hands, I said. They paused, most of them looking up suddenly at me instead. Huh? I'm serious. Do me this favor. Look at your hands. Go ahead. And then I paused for a slightly awkward length of time, as my boss taught me to do when I was 16 and selling shoes in his store. Ask if they'd like to buy them and wear them home. Then remember to wait for the answer. Don't let them off the hook by not waiting for an answer. There may be an awkward pause. Most of them started to look at their hands. Keep your eyes there, I continued. In fact, take your time now. Look at your fingertips, your palms. Picture in your mind what they have recently touched or carried. What did they hold, perhaps this morning before you arrived here? What have they recently given away? Maybe they thought I was a bit nuts, but I persisted. Those hands of yours can be used to hurt, or they can be used to heal and help, I went on. What do you use your hands for? Are you gentle with them? Did anyone teach you to be gentle with your hands? I began to imagine that they were grateful not to be hearing anything more about the liturgical practices of the late medieval church, the machinations of the Crusades and Pope Innocent III, to whom Francis first appealed for permission for his religious reform movement. I said, okay, let's move on. How about your mouth? You can't really look at your own mouth, so turn and look at the mouth of the person sitting next to you. The lips curve. They frown. They grin. Maybe they even snarl. They liked this. There was laughter as everyone seemed to choose one of these expressions. Now, consider your own mouth. What does it most often do? Does it laugh? Kiss? Is it honest? Do you use your mouth to speak in ways that are kind? Maybe not always. I think it is possible to throw words at people the way we throw things, being careless or causing damage. We should be kind with our mouths. Now they were listening carefully, which surprised me. Think now about your feet. Think about your feet as you look out the window at people on the street. Do you see someone in need of kindness? It is often easy to find someone who appears lonely. Do your feet move you in their direction? We often move around so quickly that we fail to notice when someone needs our help. Or, let's be honest, we don't much care. We see a need and instead we put our feet up. Put your heart in your feet. When was the last time you went looking for the person who needs a friend? Be honest. When was it? Whether in a classroom, at work, or on the street, it's never been easy to do the right thing because it takes a special kind of courage. We will always feel more comfortable not helping, avoiding new and uncomfortable situations. But we need to do more than be comfortable. God knows that my feet have not moved toward helping others plenty. I'm trying today to be more courageous than I was when I was your age. I hope you'll do better than I did. I knew, in a way, that I was preaching to the choir. These students were part of a group that I already knew felt marginalized. They were members of an LGBTQ club on campus. Then I added, "In all of this, I have to tell you, I'm channeling the teachings of the medieval saint I was talking about before. He's been immortalized in birdbaths everywhere, which is unfortunate. You see, this is how Francis of Assisi imagined his role in the world, in very practical ways, using his hands, his mouth, and his feet. Thomas Aquinas, another medieval saint, used to say that beauty is whatever gives pleasure on sight. He said that identifying beauty came from an intuitive understanding that people might cultivate. He said this after Gothic cathedrals had been built. He admired craftwork, fine art, flourishes of brushes and chisels and carvings, which could be found in churches all over Europe. But Francis never said a word about beauty. Unlike Thomas, Francis was an artist, a poet, a musician, and a dancer. Thomas worked only in words. Having studied Francis's life for 25 years now, I'll tell you the single most interesting thing about him is that he shows what he believes rather than tells it. He didn't indicate that he cared a whit about lovely buildings and whatever the best new carvings were. The artist Francis found his inspiration in people and other creatures, who they are and what they do in the world around him, as well as in the heavens. He shows ways of following Jesus that involve the most ordinary and tangible expressions of how to live. He wasn't about theological flights of fancy or religious arguments. He actually begged his spiritual brothers and sisters not to study theology or immerse themselves in books. So worried was he that study and reading would function like a bucket of cold water on the hot coals of their original passions. So why another book? Because Francis remained focused on being gentle, paying attention, listening and companionship, embracing the uncomfortable, even inside himself, looking for the vulnerable and not being afraid. These are some of the things that I'm trying to do in this book. And when these insights from the real Francis move into your heart, feet, mouth, and hands, then this book, this map, can be put down. Chapter 1. Find Your Siblings. He started out as Giovanni, John, with the surname Bernardone, born to privilege. His father was away on business at the time, so his mother, Pica, named him. We unfortunately know almost nothing else about her. And when Pietro returned to find he had a son, he renamed him after the place he loved most, Francesco, for France. Francis. Pietro was so successful in business that he traveled abroad to source and sell his wares, silks and fancy clothes. Most people then were bound tightly to their places. Roads were for knights going to fight, royal messengers moving between royal courts, and the occasional prelate on a mission, with soldier attendants along for safety. And for people like Pietro. Francis probably accompanied him on some of his trips. Imagine a cart piled high with silks, purples, scarlets, deep blacks, pulled by donkeys and guided by servants along dusty Roman roads. Father and son rode high on their horses, moving from Umbria through Tuscany and Florence, around the sea to Genova or north over Alpine passes, toward open and free markets, aided by local guides who were paid for the information and security they provided. This was in about the year 1195. One of those markets in the Champagne region of France is where Pietro and his son probably met traders from all over the world. About 14 years later, when he was founding a new religious order, circa 1209, Francis wrote in his Rule, a document spelling out precepts of what their life was to be about, "I command all of the brothers, when they travel about the world or reside in various places, that they never have animals with them, or entrust an animal to the care of others, or in any other way keep one. They should also never ride on horseback unless they absolutely must do so for reasons of sickness or some other great necessity." Why would a young man leave the horses and the market and the adventures of mercantile behind? Francis began to question the comfort and wisdom his father provided. How strange it must have seemed to Francis's highborn friends and to his father when he did. Francis loved horses. He loved fine things. At some point between trips, Pietro outfitted his son in fine armor, sending him off to crusade in the company of other men trying to make names for themselves. If Francis didn't want to be a silk tradesman, that was okay. He could be a knight instead. But fighting didn't go well for him, and he came back in disgrace. With Pietro angry and humiliated, Francis began to not only question his position in the world, but disdain it. He began to see beyond his privilege, though he also loved his friends and partied with them. He was well-liked and easygoing, and he always had money. But soon after that failed crusading, he began walking alone in the woods and visiting caves in the mountains. He began conversing with God. His friends, confused, watched their carefree Francis turn into something else almost overnight. Has he caught a fever? Perhaps it's his father who is demanding more of his time. But no, there he is again, not with Bernardone, but leaving the city gates, walking up into the hills. He began to steal from his father, selling those fancy silks to give money to the poor. For the first time, he was realizing that there were people in need, even living close by, and that he had a responsibility to help them. With the impulse of a teenager, he often acted poorly. He was self-righteous, justifying stealing from his father. He considered himself a sort of Robin Hood, giving the money to the poor. Then the situation got worse. One late fall afternoon, the whole town was gathered in front of the bishop's palace to witness a confrontation between Pietro and his now wayward, confused son. The crowd grew, and some climbed trees for a better view of the scene. The Umbrian sun was cold, casting long shadows on the stone piazza. The bishop was awkward. He didn't want trouble. The only one looking for trouble that day was Pietro, who demanded respect. In front of the bishop and the town, he laid out his case, refusing to look at Francis as he did, directing himself to the prelate who he believed could exact an apology and the necessary obedience from his son. Francis listened, looking around at the hundreds of faces staring back at him. people he'd known his whole life. What he must have been thinking at that moment, I wish I knew. Most people who experience defeat, embarrassment, and family discord, and who so radically change who they are, leave their childhood friends behind before it all plays out in front of them. Not Francis. Everyone he knew must have been looking on at that moment. I can't imagine the intense gaze that the crowd must have placed upon Francis. In an act of defiance, he stripped naked, as if to make real what had already been done to him metaphorically, in front of everyone, including his father and the bishop and the people hanging from the trees. Francis removed every single thing. Thomas of Celano, the first Francis biographer, says that he took everything off and threw them on the ground. Another account says that he paused and folded them. What a spectacle! A public referendum at first on Francis, then turning the gaze, the judgment, on his father. The scene would have elicited a mixture of laughter and gasps from those who watched as Francis stripped the remnants of his father's influence from himself and laid them at his father's feet. Respect? I only have a father in heaven now, he said, with what would become a characteristic flair. The bishop, in the middle of this embarrassing scene, grabbed a cassock and quickly draped it over Francis's narrow shoulders. He must have then shrugged to Pietro. There was no stopping the fearlessness of this young man. Francis may have lacked courage wearing a knight's armor, but he seemed valiant wearing nothing at all. He had found something else, something brighter and bolder that allowed him to be free. Many other well-known saints have anecdotes of their childhood, their birth, and even their conception to demonstrate how they were prepared for holiness, as if what they did in their adult lives was a foregone conclusion, evidence of sanctity explained with miracles. Of Francis, there are no such stories. In fact, we can assume that rather than a life formed in a string of supernatural events, Francis was lonely as a child. We know that he had siblings, but nothing in his teachings or stories or accounts speaks of them. Instead, the witness of Francis's life is that families of origin can be very messy. When he took off his clothes, he ended up rejecting his father. He didn't choose his siblings. What he did next was leave the town for the dark silence of those caves in the mountains, before heading for the way of the open road. As G.K. Chesterton memorably describes the moment, he went out, half naked, a man without a father. He was penniless, he was parentless, he was, to all appearances, without a trade, or a plan, or a hope in the world. And as he went under the frosty trees, he burst suddenly into song. Francis wasn't drawn to the security of a monastery. He sought God alone. Security he wanted to let go of. In those days, in the early 1200s, monastery life provided an alternative parentage suitable for a misfit like Francis. In a monastery, he would have elders who could answer his questions and guide him in sure ways. He would have the certainty of food on the table, a fine education, structure and order of his days, books for learning, and a choir or craft to busy his mind and hands. He could have channeled his desire for seeking God and virtue behind a monastery's thick stone walls. But Francis was drawn elsewhere, to places undefined. Strangely, he wanted a spiritual life that was unpredictable, without guarantees, without abbots, without securities. How unusual this was, and still is. He'd heard the Gospels, heard them, he likely didn't read, and he knew that what Jesus wanted from human beings was much simpler and more beautiful, more human than anything he'd ever heard in church. Given this, it is amazing that Francis of Assisi didn't go down in history as a heretic but instead became the world's most appreciable saint. He went on to create a life and body of teachings that still astound people centuries later.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?